An Osho Talk. Zen, the Diamond Thunderbolt, number 4.
Once a monk asked Joshu, "What is the body without illness?" Joshu said, "The body made of the 4 elements and 5 skandhas." On another occasion, Umon asked a monk, "What are you?" He replied, "I'm the head of the infirmary." "You don't mean to say so," said Umon. "Is there anybody not ill?" "I don't understand," replied the monk. "Why can't you understand?" asked Umon. The monk was silent, and then Umon said, "Ask me the same question." So the monk asked Umon, "Who is the man without any illness?" Umon pointed to the next monk. Once there was a monk ill in the infirmary who asked to see Tozan. When Tozan went there, the monk said to him, "Why don't you save ordinary people?" Tozan asked him, "Who is your family?" The monk replied, "A great Ichantika family." Tozan remained silent for some time. Then the monk said, "What shall we do when the 4 mountains come pressing round us?" Tozan said, "I myself came from under the roof of a family." The monk said, "Is there relativity or no relativity?" Tozan answered, "None." The monk asked, "Where will you let me go?" "To a rice field," answered Tozan. The monk heaved a sigh and said, "Goodbye," and died sitting there. Tozan tapped him on the head 3 times with his staff and said, "Like this, you knew how to die, but not how to live." When Tozan was about to die, he made a verse, "My road is beyond the blue sky. The clouds never make any commotion. In this world there is a tree without any roots. Its yellow leaves send back the wind." After saying this, he passed away.
Yonisef. Before I enter into your tremendously significant anecdotes, I have to reply again to the old goat of Puri, Shankaracharya. He is such a nice fellow. He goes on inventing such things that you cannot even imagine. Now he has come with the idea that I'll lead in the ashram every day a procession of naked women. Do you think you could have imagined it? Now these 7,000 people are an evidence, but who will tell this idiot I have to send Sardar because it is a question between Pune and Puri. Only Sardar can convince him, tapping 3 times on his head, that stop talking nonsense. Another thing he has said, that he cannot bring its negative certificate because he is a celibate. Celibate or no celibate, if you want to discuss with me in this assembly of Buddhas, you will have to bring the certificate. And particularly because you are a celibate, the certificate has become an absolute necessity. It is out of celibacy that homosexuality has arisen, and the AIDS is the final flowering of homosexuality. It is a very religious phenomenon. The Buddhist monks, the Christian monks, the Hindu monks, they are the originator of homosexuality. And the whole credit goes to these monks for bringing AIDS to the world. Celibacy is the cause of AIDS. Secondly, his idea that I lead a procession of naked ladies proves simply that he has become really a Hindu saint, because all Hindu scriptures are full of stories that whenever a Hindu saint reaches to its highest sagehood, the god becomes afraid because he may dethrone him. So he sends beautiful women to distract the mind of the sage. And obviously, up to now, they have been successful in distracting, because God has not been replaced. But one thing proves certainly that Shankaracharya of Puri is a sage. He has started dreaming naked procession of apsaras. Apsaras are heavenly prostitutes. But why I should enter into his dreams. To me, he is a Harijan, untouchable. It reminds me Sigmund Freud's great insight that people who remain celibate long start dreaming of women, or if they are women, they start dreaming of men. Now his idea of a procession is perfectly right as far as Hindu sages are concerned. But I was not the leader of the procession. Perhaps Swami Agnivesh, who goes on leading processions of Harijans, and now has declared that he is going to lead processions in Bihar, in Karnataka, and in other provinces. But instead of Agnivesh, he is really afraid of me. It is his fear, because Agnivesh belongs to the same rotten tradition. Just they are playing different roles to exploit the Hindus. One, the higher classes, one, the lower classes. But their aim is the same. But he is certainly afraid of me if he has seen me in his dreams. Sigmund Freud's insight was that you dream only if you suppress something. He must be suppressing a great anger against me, otherwise he cannot dream. And for his dream I am not responsible. He can dream anything he wants. There was a pharaoh in Egypt who declared to the kingdom that if anybody enters into my dreams, the next day morning he will be beheaded. His whole court became very afraid that this is a very strange thing. Nobody can enter into anybody's dream. It is your dream. You are projecting something and you are throwing the responsibility on somebody else. The Shankaracharya must be seeing in his dreams naked women. But the strangest part is that I am even watching in his dreams the procession of the naked ladies. He knows I will expose him. It is his fear and anger and his repressed sex all together, that creates the dream. But for it, except him, nobody else is responsible. Thirdly, he has come with a new idea. He always comes with new ideas. He is such an original idiot. You cannot find any comparison in the whole world. He has come to the conclusion that man and women are not equal, cannot be equal, because their sexual organs are different. This is a new criterion, never heard before. And does he has ever wondered about breasts? Perhaps he has breasts also. Just dry buttons. If it has to be decided by genitals, who is superior and who is inferior, then woman is going to be superior, because she is the mother. Just think, if man and women had same kind of genital mechanism, how idiots like Puri Shankaracharya would have been born. The world would have been very dry. Everybody moving here and there with his sexual organ, hanging sad, weeping. The difference between man and woman does not mean that they are not equal. It simply means they are different. They have to be different, otherwise there will be no reproduction. But just because they are different, you cannot condemn them as inferior. And Hinduism has been doing it for centuries. So I cannot blame him. He is simply repeating like a parrot old rotten scriptures without even bothering that he will be laughed at. He is very courageous. He does not care what the intelligentsia of the world will think of him and his religion. I want the other 7 Shankaracharyas, because there are 8 Shankaracharyas in India, for all 8 directions, the 7 Shankaracharyas should meet together and dethrone this fool, he is doing immense harm to your religion, to your respectability, and he is making Hinduism a laughing stock. But all those seven Sankaracharyas are absolutely silent. Perhaps they also agree with him. Obviously, he is supported by Hindu scriptures. A tremendous revolution is needed in Hinduism to get rid of all that nonsense that Hinduism has carried for thousands of years. The woman is inferior, the Sudra is untouchable, that the Brahmin, whether he deserves it or not, has to be respected. All these obscurantist ideas should be thrown away. Hinduism needs a tremendous cleaning, a dry cleaning. But because of these people who pretend to be heads of the religion, millions of Hindus cannot even raise a question against them. Because I have raised questions against him, now letters have started coming to me that you are insulting our heads. That man has any head? Do I have to insult a man who has no head at all? And he has given the challenge to have a discussion with me on these matters. Now he is not talking about it. Seeing the situation, he has stopped talking about controversy. Rather, he has started asking the government to arrest me. What crime I have committed that I should be arrested? Just because I have questioned a stupid man and called a spade just a fucking spade. This is no crime. Now, let us be for the moment spiritual. Once a monk asked Josu, what is the body without illness? Joseph said, the body made of the four elements and five skandhas. The questioner was asking, is there anything in the body that is without illness? Because as far as body is concerned, it is full of illnesses. Old age, and finally death. Joseph's answer was a little very subtle. He said the body is made of chemistry and physics. But there is someone behind watching this, that it is made of four elements and five skandhas. That watching one is without illness. It is without birth and without death. On another occasion, Umon asked a monk, what are you? He replied, I am the head of the infirmary. You don't mean to say so? Said Umon, is there anybody not ill? I don't understand, replied the monk. Why can't you understand? Asked Umon. The monk was silent, and then Umon said, ask me the same question. So the monk asked Umon, who is the man without any illness? Umon pointed to the next monk. Zen is so strange in its methods and devices that unless you are very silent and deep in meditation, you will not understand even these simple anecdotes. When the man asked again, who is the man without any illness? Umon, without saying anything to him, pointed to the next monk, asking him, do you have also any question? This means that the question that the monk is asking is unanswerable. There is someone in you without illness. Even when you are sick, your consciousness is as whole and healthy as it has always been. You may be a child, you may be young, you may be old, you may be dying, but your consciousness remains without any illness. And that is your reality, your existence. To ask unnecessary questions is simply to waste the time of the master. Once there was a monk ill in the infirmary who asked to see Tozan. When Tozan went there, the monk said to him, "Why don't you save ordinary people?" Tozan asked, "Who is your family?" The monk replied, "A great Ichantika family." Now this word Ichantika comes from Sanskrit Ekantika. In the times of Gautam Buddha, there were two schools of thought. The Ekantikas, who believe that there is only one consciousness, one existence, one, that is the meaning of ek, ekant, ekantika, who believes in one cosmos without another. And the other school was called anekant. Jainism is that other school. They believe that there are as many souls as there are living beings. And they contain, even in the final realization, their individuality. Gautam Buddha is not ekantika. It is very difficult to understand unless you understand the difference between your personality and your individuality. The personality will be lost. As higher you reach, the personality will disappear. It is just a paper bag. But that does not mean that your individuality, your center of being will disappear. Yes, it will throb with the universe, it will dance with the universe, there will be no barrier between it and the universe, but it will remain as individual as it has never been. In fact, to attain this individuality, this aloneness, which is not against the universe, which is an absolute tune with the universe, so in a way it can be said you have disappeared in the ocean, or it can be said the ocean has disappeared in you. But one thing is certain, that there is no barrier anymore. Nothing divides you, but it is a question not to be discussed, it is something to be experienced, a dew drop dropping into the ocean from the outside seems to disappear, but from the inside it remains itself. Although it loses all distinctions, all discriminations, all divisions, all separations, it has become one with the cosmos, but it is. The feeling of isness is more acute and sharp in the ultimate realization . So when the monk said, I come from a great Ekantika family, Tozan remained silent for some time. Then the monk said, what shall we do when the four mountains come pressing round us? Tozan said, I myself came under the roof of a family. The monk said, is there relativity or no relativity? Tozan answered, none. The monk asked, where will you let me go? You are closing all doors. Tozan was a great man of understanding. He said, to a rice field. The monk heaved a sigh and said goodbye and died sitting there. Tozan tapped him on the head. That's what Sardar Gurdayal Singh has to do. Tozan tapped him on the head 3 times with his staff and said, like this you knew how to die, but not how to live. The real thing is the art of living. If you know how to live, you will automatically know how to die. But knowing to die is not enough. Anybody can commit a suicide. There are simple ways of leaving the body. Even without poison, there have existed methods in yoga, in tantra, in Zen, in which you can stop your heart and you can exhale your breathing. This may be a miracle to others, but this is not the way of a right, intelligent, understanding man. This is not the way of the Buddha. First, you have to learn to live rightly, with awareness, consciousness, love, compassion. Your life first has to become a dance worthy to be offered to the existence there. Death is a small affair, a single moment thing. In a split second you will die, but life is eternal. And if you know the grace and the beauty and the joy and the splendor of life, you will die joyously, laughingly, because you know death is a fiction, the greatest fiction. It has never happened. You have simply moved the house. I am reminded of Mullah Nasruddin. One night a thief entered into his house. He was sleeping, but he opened one of his eyes and looked at the thief and closed his eye. The thief was a little afraid. A strange man opens one eye, sees me and still says nothing and remains completely still. So he quickly gathered whatever he could, and as he was going out, Mullah Nasruddin took his blanket, covered himself, it was a cold night, and followed the thief. The thief looked back. He said, "What are you doing?" He said, "Nothing. We are changing home." You have carried everything. Now what I am supposed to do? I am coming along. A man of enlightenment simply moves houses. When the body becomes too old, and is not a joy to be in the old dilapidated house, one leaves it. But one can leave either consciously or unconsciously. If you leave unconsciously, you don't know what has happened. You will open your eyes in some womb. You will not know from where you are coming and why you are here in this womb. You will be born, but you will not know why you are born. If you cannot die consciously, you cannot burn consciously. They are two poles of the same reality. A man who can die consciously, meditatively, moves either into another womb. If his consciousness is not yet total, or if his consciousness is total, he moves into the formless sky. Now no more bondage. Except unconsciousness, there is no bondage anywhere. When Suzanne was about to die, he made a verse. Now look with this kind of strange people. He is going to die and he is writing a poem. In Zen it has become a tradition that before dying you should write a poem, just to show your insight for the coming generations, that you have not died unconsciously, that you knew death is coming without knowing that death is coming. How can you write the last verse? He wrote, "My road is beyond the blue sky. The clouds never make any commotion. In this world there is a tree without any roots. Its yellow leaves send back the wind." After saying this, he passed away. What a way to die, and what a way to live. Just today I received an information from Europe. A famous astrologer, almost worshipped like a prophet, has declared years before that at a certain date he will die. Now the date has come, and he was in great difficulty. So he committed suicide. But this is not the way of Zen. They are not committing suicide. They simply see that this body needs rest, that this body has done its work, that this life has ripened its fruits, that this life has experienced all that was available. Now it is time to go on a pilgrimage. They call it cloud pilgrimage. Just like a cloud without creating any disturbance, moving without direction, knowing not where they are going, just enjoying the very going. A haiku reads, if you do not believe, look at September, look at October, how the yellow leaves fall and fill mountain and river. A man of awakening just drops like a dry leaf when the time comes. No grudge, no clinging, no desire to go on living in this body, trusting absolutely that life will continue. But this is possible only if you enter yourself and experience the continuum of existence. Manisha has asked, we make life a struggle and death a struggle. Is not graciousness simply the ability to live while alive and die when dying? Manisha, unless you are awakened to your innermost self, this grace will not be available to you. It is true, to live gracefully while alive and to die gracefully while dying. The grace remains as a shadow of consciousness. The moment you are unconscious, you lose your grace, you lose your beauty, you lose everything that life is ready to give to you, but you are not ready to receive it. We will try today again, dying gracefully, and then let us see how many come back gracefully. Few come too quickly. They were just waiting for Nivedan. Few remain longer, enjoying the beautiful death, then get up and start moving towards the canteen. Because one is not supposed here in Buddha Hall to die forever. This is a place to live forever. If you want to die, you can move towards the canteen. Paddy and Samus are drinking in the pub on St. Patrick's Day. Hey, Paddy, slobber Samus, tell me again, what the hell was it that St. Patrick did? He chased all of the snakes out of Ireland, replies Paddy. That is it, says Samus, taking another drink. But where the hell is he now, when we need him the most, to chase all those bananas out of the White House? You got it, but a little late. Let us try another. Caruso and his buddy Leonardo, two Italian crickets, meet in the garden Caruso is walking with a limp, and Leonardo notices he has a bandage on his prick. "What happened to you?" asked Leonardo. "Last night," says Caruso, "I was feeling like I'm making love. So I got on my best suit and bruised it back, my wings, and went out into the city lights. But ask Leonardo the cricket, why you got the bandage on your salami?" "Well," says Caruso, "I was walking along when suddenly I see this gorgeous firefly. So I come up slowly and silently, and then I jumped on her." "Wow!" exclaims Leonardo. "But what happened?" "Mamma mia!" cries Caruso. "It was no firefly. It was somebody's old cigar." Miss White was the prim young librarian is in her spare time a lieutenant in Christ's Salvation Army. She moves into a new apartment and does not know anybody else in the building. One day, she needs a screwdriver to hang up her picture of Jesus, but she does not have one. So, plucking up her courage, she decides to borrow one from her neighbor across the hall. When the door opened, she sobbed, but secretly impressed to be confronted by a huge Rambo-type guy dressed only in his underwear. She is suitably flustered, but this smiling hulk in jockey shorts, but nevertheless manages to remember what she came for. "Hi," she stammers, "I am your new screw across the hall. Can I use your driver, neighbor?" After checking into the hotel, Father O'Dilly finds a Bible on the bedside table. He reads it for a couple of hours and then leaves his room and wanders into the lobby. There he strikes up a conversation with the pretty young receptionist. After she has finished work, they share a few drinks in the bar and then retire to Father O'Dilly's room. But when the priest starts removing her clothes, she begins to have second thoughts. "Are you sure this is all right?" she asks. "I mean, you are a priest." "Don't worry, my dear," he replies, "it is written in the Bible." She believes him and the two of them spend a very pleasant night together. But in the morning, as the girl is preparing to leave, she says, "You know, Father, I don't remember that part in the Bible you mentioned last night. Could you show it to me?" So the priest takes the Bible from the bedside table, opens the cover, and points to the bottom of the title page where someone has written in pencil, "The girl in reception is Cruz." Nivedana, give the first beat. Be silent. Close your eyes. No movement. Just feel as if you are frozen. In this silent space, enter inwards, deeper, more deeper, without any fear. It is your own home. Just go deep like a thunderbolt, like an arrow towards the center. And the closer you reach to the center, the more you are in tune with existence. This is the only prayer the only worship and when you settle down in your center, your heart is beating in tune with the universe. This is the very meaning of life. To get deeper, nivedano, relax, let go, die. Don't be worried. Let the body go on breathing. It will take care of itself. It knows its way. You concentrate your consciousness inwards. In this silent moment, you become Buddhas. Every day you become Buddhas and forget again. At least this time don't forget, because who knows tomorrow. Will come or not. Go as deep as you can. Don't hold back. Fully conscious, even death is a dance. Without consciousness, even life is worthless. In this silence have blossomed all the great roses, lotuses. In this silence have emerged great grace, love, freedom. This silence is the source of all great poetry, art, music. Let this silence become your 24-hour presence. I am saying it because if it is possible for me, why it is not possible for you? Nivedana, call all the Buddhas back to life. And for few seconds sit silently in the immense treasure that you have discovered, in the great sky that has opened, the blue sky above the clouds. Can we celebrate the thousands of Buddhas assembled here?